bicycle crash is not an accident. And when you find yourself in a situation that calls for experienced, effective, and positive legal support and advocacy, you can depend on any of North America's independent Bike Law members. Bike Law's cycling attorneys are members of our community committed to the pursuit of cycling safety and justice. For more information about Bike Law, log on to bikelaw.com. They're on your left, protecting your rights.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show is heard every Saturday morning, 7:30 a.m. in Northeastern Ohio on WJCU 88.7 FM and streamed at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for February 22nd, 2020. Only two more weeks until daylight savings time. More daylight, yes sir. You can get out and ride earlier or stay out and ride later. It's also the last chance for Radiothon over the next few days. We're so close to our goal of $50,000, and your pledge can help put us over. You can pledge your support by calling 216-397-4438, and we can take your pledge over the phone. Or you can log on to WJCU.org and click the Radiothon pledge button. No amount is too small. Remember that all pledges go directly to the station. This window of opportunity will close Monday night, February 24th at midnight, so please take a moment and pledge your support to WJCU, the station that supports the Outspoken Cyclist. So let's get on with this week's show. Tonight we meet one of, if not the only, female bicycle mechanic on the pro cyclocross circuit. Brenna Rye Simpson started out as a music major, but when she needed an inexpensive bike for transportation, she found herself taking in all that the two local bike shops near her college in Portland, Oregon, could offer. She also fell in with a group of cyclists, and from there, Brenna not only started working at the bike shop, she began what is now a professional road racing career, and she manages her employer's shop's women's cross team. Brenna is all about team, and we'll learn more in a moment. Then we meet with Ellie Sias. When Ellie had exhausted all of the bicycle tours she could find in the time she had available to her and found her life partner on one of those tours, it became crystal clear to her that she needed to start her own touring company. Together with her partner, Dennis Hughes, Ellie started Cycle of Life Adventures, and one of them accompanies every tour they offer. We'll meet Ellie in the second half of the show. So from the perspective of someone who is on the ground racing today, Brenna Rye Simpson gives us a solid look at what makes a successful women's racing team, working for the shop that sponsors it, going on the road as the team mechanic, and learning racing from the ground up, which has led her to a pro career in addition to her other duties. Hi, Brenna. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Oh, thanks for having me, Diane. It's really great to be here.
Well, I'm very excited about talking to you. You are one of those people who gets more work done in a day than anybody, and I'm also one of those people, so it always makes me feel good when somebody's like, starts at the beginning of the day, ends at the end of the day, and goes, I've got so much accomplished, and you do, it seems.
That's really kind of you to say.
Well, okay, maybe I made it up, but I don't think so. So you are, okay, so here's the cool stuff. For the people who are just starting to listen to the show today, Brenna is a mechanic, a bicycle mechanic. She races road, she races cross, she manages a team, she works at a shop, and she started out as a music major. So we'll try and figure out how all that happened. Where did you grow up?
Well, I'm an Oregon native. I grew up in Corvallis, which is a smaller college town situated right in the heart of the Willamette Valley, and definitely a beautiful place to ride all kinds of bikes, on road and off. And I didn't really have anything to do with that growing up, so I did use a bike for transportation. And I would say that Corvallis's friendly level for that played a pretty big role in, you know, just having an easy relationship with riding a bike around town early on. That's how it started.
Okay. And so what was your interest in music? I mean, did you play an instrument? Do you sing?
When I was growing up, I was excited about the idea of learning how to play piano, first of all. And I think that that started because my mom and I wound up subletting a professor's home in Corvallis, and there was a piano there. So I think it was like situational excitement at first, you know, oh, this is a cool thing. I want to know how to use it. And it sounds fun, but how do you use it? And then the elementary school that I went to, the music teacher who worked there also ran a very well-organized, rather large-scale community choir, so outside of the public school system. And it was really engaging to me, and a lot of the kids that I was friends with sang in this choir, and I wanted to be a part of it. So at a pretty young age, social structure of playing in a big group was really fun to me, and like kind of learning how to be a part of something bigger than yourself has always appealed to me. So that's how I got into music, basically.
Well, it's interesting you say something bigger than yourself, because that has clearly been your life continuing onward. That's one of the things I learned about you almost right away, was that it's about this teamwork and the relationships that you form. So we will get to that. So how did you transition from music? And I don't know where you went to school. Did you go to college?
Yeah, I did go to school. Yeah. So fast forwarding through high school, you know, I spent a lot of time in various musical groups, either through the school system and outside of it, and knew that was like the form of, I mean, I always thought that it was good to challenge yourself and have a broad diversity of learning and subjects, but I definitely knew that music was the avenue that I liked focusing on for your studies and what I liked to learn about. So I planned on just continuing studying music when I went to school, and was excited about the idea of maybe being a teacher someday. So I thought, you know, I'll find a good place to go to school and study what I know I will finish a degree in, and work on being an educator later. And I wound up with a special opportunity to be able to go to Reed College in Portland, which is a small liberal arts school. That's how I moved to Portland from Corvallis. So yeah, I studied there. And in the course of studying there, I befriended a variety of people who rode bikes. I think that's a pretty common thing for a lot of people when they go to college, you know, getting around on a bike is like an efficient thing to do, an easy and efficient and cheap thing to do. I had never ridden a road bike until I went to college and borrowed one from an old friend. And it was very different from riding the older GP mountain bike that I'd, you know, commuted on around Corvallis growing up. And pretty captivating to me right away. Like, it's one of those human memories that sticks with you throughout your adulthood of like just a very captivating experience that maybe was kind of critical or transformative. It didn't yield anything specific as far as like, oh, I've ridden a road bike, now I want to see what it's like to race a road bike, but I did want one. So as a broke college kid, I needed to figure out how to get one. I've always been pretty resourceful and interested in creative problem solving. So I bought a cheap steel frame on Craigslist and then started visiting the two bike shops that were closest to campus and buying small tools and buying small parts to be able to put together a pretty simple road bike, and asking a lot of questions. I also had a good friend in school who was running the campus bike co-op, who was super amazing about just walking me through how to assemble this thing, basically. Read the Learns In Bike Maintenance book top to bottom and asked a lot of questions. And that's how my initial love of road riding started.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Brenna Rye Simpson, and I can't even give you all of the things and all of the hats she wears yet. I want to ask you about your nickname before I forget. Why do people call you Bruno? I mean, when you look at you, you are not exactly brutish. You're sort of this thin, tall, you know, blonde lady. So where did you come up with the name Bruno, or who came up with it?
That's great. It's a fun nickname that happened totally by accident. We had a cyclocross race in the Portland area called the Battle of Barlow for a number of years. It was one of the, like, kind of season opening mainstay events. And I was racing it one year, and the men's and women's and masters men's A fields all, like, line up sequentially and then start 30 seconds or a minute apart or what have you. So my current employer, Eric Tonkin, who owns Solid Cycle Repair, was lined up in the men's A field, and I was lined up in the women's A field behind that. And one of our coworkers was babysitting Eric's kids, who were pretty young at this point, a number of years ago. And our coworker said, "Now don't forget to cheer for Eric and Brenna while they're racing today." And Eric's son, he cheered and said my name. I heard him in, you know, somewhere on course each lap, and maybe halfway through the race, he just had a great, like, total kid brain fart moment where he just forgot what he was trying to say mid cheer and paused and then said, "Go Bruno." And it was just a great, very comical moment. And the kids were pretty, you know, tickled by the joke. So they retold the story to us at the shop later and to their parents. And then because of that, the name is stuck, everybody in the shop started calling me that. And it's a funny accidental moment.
Yeah. Out of the mouths of babes. Right. Right.
Totally.
So let's talk a second about Sellwood. So Sellwood Cycle Repair is the shop you now work for. One of the things that's cool about Sellwood is that I guess they've always had a cross team, cyclocross team. And now you happen to manage that team. So, I mean, the mechanic part, I imagine you just kind of were able to do this stuff. Clearly, you actually have become a skilled mechanic. And did you learn all that at Sellwood?
I started working at Sellwood in 2014. So I just celebrated, I guess, my 6-year anniversary working here, because it was February of that year. So here we are. And previous to that, I worked for Chris King for about a year. And then prior to that, I worked at another Portland bike shop called Bike Gallery for about 5 years. You know, bridging my time in college and then into the workforce afterwards. So, like, part time for a couple of years and then full time for a few years after that. So my education working on bikes started while I was working at Bike Gallery, and it came from, you know, a variety of learning from friends outside of work, and then, you know, from compassionate coworkers and, you know, accruing skills on the job. That partially answers your question.
Well, no, actually, it answers it quite well, because it's clear that they were willing to help you and teach you, and you were a willing learner.
I really wanted it too. So, yeah, I think that this is, you know, bicycle mechanics are a subject that are constantly changing, but there are a lot of similarities from era to era, and it's a really fun subject that is super engaging, and it requires you to continue learning over time. And so I would say that when I joined the staff at Sellwood, I think that I got an even more awesome variety of knowledge, you know, continuing knowledge and education on the job, and that doesn't really stop, you know, even as I've had the opportunity to assume this role as a manager of our cyclocross program and to have kind of the fun job of doing race mechanic support and traveling a lot. It's like working on bikes is constantly changing, and you learn more skills as you keep working within it. So, yeah, I can talk a little bit more about the bike shop and the team and how that works if you'd like to.
Yeah. Let me remind our listeners once again, though, that we're speaking with Brenna Rise Simpson, and I do want to talk a little bit more about the team and about your attitude towards helping teammates succeed. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk with Brenna some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Back. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Brenna Rye Simpson. She is a bike mechanic. Now, the way I found her is there was a headline, I don't even remember where it was, only female cyclocross mechanic on the race circuit. So she travels as a bike mechanic. She also races as, you still just race road or do you race cross too?
If there's an opportunity to race a race at home, then I absolutely will race some cyclocross at home, but it's pretty impossible to be a rider and a staff member.
Good point.
Yeah.
Good point. So let's talk a little bit about team and racing. So you do manage this, it's called S&M. Now, you know, some people could interpret that one way or another. Does it have a meaning that may be different from what some people might think?
Yes, it does.
Oh, good.
I'll go ahead and throw in a fun added here about, well, Solwood Cycle Repair has been in the Solwood neighborhood in Portland for over 20 years. And for much of that time frame, there has always been a team S&M, which is the bike racing part of the shop environment that's outside of the shop, you know, like the orange jersey in Oregon and beyond racing. Technically, S&M stands for Solwood and Moreland, which are the two neighborhoods that the bike shop is situated in, but of course it's a fun play on words, you know.
Yes.
There's a little bit of a like self-punishment element that goes into bike racing, of course. So
good point. Good point.
So that's kind of the historical name and how it came to be. And it's shepherded a lot of regional riders from their home racing and first environments onto bigger careers. So yeah.
You have a really interesting philosophy on racing, and that is, I read that you are interested in the setup, meaning helping your teammates succeed. I mean, you have had your share of wins, but tell me about this idea that the team and helping your teammates succeed is so important to you.
Yeah, happy to. I would say that I never would have started racing a bike if I hadn't met a certain combination of people who were involved in local Oregon bike racing that did a really good job of emphasizing personal relationships on a team and how they can affect fundamentals of teamwork on the road. And I'll just speak to, you know, bike racing and how it works as far as team dynamics are concerned from the road, because that's my background. But yeah, I was lucky enough to get into road riding, and then I had a coworker at the time who was racing for the Oregon Ironclad Cycling Team, which has been around for over 14 years now and changed names a couple of times. Now it's called the Rainier Cycling Team. But the wonderful fellow Dave Alderbase, who's managed that program, has always done a great job of teaching fundamentals of road racing to a fun-loving group. And I think at the local level, that like fun factor and personal investment in each other goes a long way towards wanting to play off of each other and set up your teammates for success and take turns, you know, in terms of getting across the line first or whatever the goal is for the day. But he did an excellent job of teaching a willing group of us Cat 4 women that joined the team that particular year on how to attack and counterattack and play off of each other and lead a race and set each other up for on a given day that would play to our strengths. That's what kept me really excited about bike racing from the beginning. It's so much more than like going out and riding by yourself as hard as you can. You know, that's the, in some ways, the easy part, you know?
Yeah, sure. Get on your bike and hammer. Sure.
Right. And it's like far less interesting to me personally, just because it's so much more controlled, you know? Learning how to effectively communicate and work with, you know, up to five other people on a squad and set a goal for success for the team, whether that's winning or not, is like, it's critical and really fun and engaging to me. So,
do you think there are enough opportunities for women to race today? Now, you're lucky you're in an area. Oregon has a lot of racing. West Coast has a lot of racing. We're here in Ohio where there's some. And of course, you know, you can go all over the country and find something. But do you think women have enough opportunities? And what do you think it would take to bring women's racing into the vision of people who follow cycling?
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of really powerful opportunities across the board for racing your bike in America, and that racing a bike here is something that you can choose to do and find a community, hopefully. I know that varies so wildly across the country, so that's one of our biggest, you know, quagmires, is that like the U.S. is huge and how well seeded or founded an area of cycling is per region is so different from place to place. And I think that in women's racing, it's a good example of like one of the smaller cross sections or fields. So you tend to see less participation or in that area because it's a smaller field to begin with. I think that road racing overall in the U.S. is seeing lower numbers turn out for it. I don't know exactly what the fix is to that, but I do think that like there are a number of events that are empowering and attractive out there. So there are opportunities to ride in terms of visibility and sport. There have been a lot of advances thanks to a lot of hard work of advocates and athletes to make women's racing more visible and accessible. And we know that being able to watch a sport and see it performed is so critical to understanding it well, especially if there's a access or learning gap. You know, if you're a beginning road racer and you're trying to visualize what does this sport really look like on a bigger level where there's a deep field and strong teamwork from several well-formed teams playing off of each other, you know, that's a pretty big gap from what you see in most of your regional road races. Having some form of like broadcasting that exhibits what racing can look like is super critical, and then having like strong role models that are exhibited, you know, within the media for people to look up to, it's super important for the advancement of women's racing. I think that there are a lot of really strong races on the domestic calendar that are prioritizing a women's field, you know, maintaining their women's fields and providing, you know, demonstrations of equality, such as equivalent payout, and that's critical too. I do think that, so in short answer to your question, I do think that there are opportunities to race. I think that as racers, it's critical for us to remember how difficult race promotion is, especially at the local level, and to do our utmost to give back to the generation of those events in whatever way you can. Local racing is where people find their introduction to the sport, and it's where people decide if they're going to stick with it or not. So providing some amount of energy and support to an event, even if it's just showing up, but usually if it's helping to broadcast the event or volunteer at the event, or if you're in a position to help sponsor the event, that's super helpful for continuing to grow cycling across the country. It starts in your own backyard.
I agree. What do you think keeps sponsors engaged in supporting cycling, women's or men's? Mm-hmm. I mean, what is it that your boss sees about his team that makes him want to keep putting money into it?
Yeah. Well, I think it's important to point out, you know, Fellwood is a vehicle for getting people on bikes no matter what. And that does include a pretty forward emphasis of racing, but also in an inviting way. So Eric and the shop are regular partners of our Oregon racing calendar, sponsoring a variety of mountain bike, road, and gravel events, along with a number of cross events. I think that's honestly a really big thing to emphasize, is that continued, you know, partnership with the events in our area. And then also providing like a home for people to find racing by wearing the S&M jersey. Our cyclocross program, Team S&M CX, is a very condensed example of racing at the highest level, and continuing to support development by making sure that there is a women's professional cyclocross team going to these events, taking women from our area there. I think that for most sponsoring companies or partners, there's always some level of personal investment in the sport. I think that bike racing provides a really beautiful avenue for a lot of human elements that we can relate to. I mean, as humans, we enjoy like learning games and being challenged and learning systems and learning how to be our best selves. And you can do that in a lot of different ways, but obviously sport is a really great place for that. And racing a bike is just one of those manifestations. So for sponsors, there's a very like large scale human development potential in bike racing. And I think that if I was to speak for Eric and for the shop, that's where our interest lies in continuing to be a sponsor and partner and like outspoken representative of bike racing on the grassroots and elite levels, you know, helping people to become their best selves through their athleticism. But it tends to translate to the human level too, in terms of how we do it. That's probably a pretty touchy feely answer, but that's the easiest one for me to.
I think it's really pretty solid. It's a good, solid answer. I like it because it's got all of the elements that make it real. And so I know a lot of shops try to sponsor, but they don't have that. I don't think they have that philosophy. And so I think it's a good explanation of what makes a successful team, which also helps to make a successful shop. So you represent the shop as well as the shop, you know, sponsoring you. So I have a couple of more real simple questions. What are your plans? Are you going to be racing this season, 2020?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. The timing of this conversation is pretty great. I literally just returned to the shop from my spring road camp with my road team, DNA Pro Cycling. We were in the Bay Area doing our first little block of training together. So yeah, we are a UCI women's pro team, and we are definitely focused on similar things to just what I just, you know, mentioned about like role modeling and trying to be our best selves on and off the bike. So we do a lot of USA Crit events because the structure of that series is really great and paramount for visibility of the sport. They do an awesome job of like trying to model what other league sports do of you know, inviting teams into a D1 situation where there's co-advertisement of the league and the individual players and taking it all over the country, and then also providing live streaming for every single event, which is huge, to be able to just see what does this really look like. Obviously, crit racing is one of, kind of similarly to cross racing by nature, it's, you know, closed small circuit, and so it's more approachable and easy to just see up close for a spectator, so that makes it pretty fun and inviting. I think that's another thing that will help keep, you know, bike racing cool.
Well, it's also plenty dangerous.
You know, people, yeah, also that. Yeah, there's certainly
there's certainly, you know, added speed and risk within it, but also a lot of skill that
right.
kind of
balances
that. And a lot of cultivation of teaching each other how to ride safely together. So there are several other key standalone events that the team will be going to, culminating with Colorado Classic at the end of the season, which is, you know, it's a super special event in the domestic and world schedule, being a standalone women's stage race, and, you know, also offers a lot of the same co-advertisement and, like, just incredibly professional representation of women's athleticism and what potential is there.
Are you going to be at Sea Otter?
We will have some folks from the team at Sea Otter. I'm not particularly sure if I will be there.
I'll be there.
Yeah,
I'm going to be doing some on-the-ground podcasting. So if you're there, just come to the media tent and we'll have a chat.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Okay,
we'll
so what do you do when you're not working, wrenching, racing, coaching? You have to do something different from bicycles. What do you do when bicycles is not in the sentence?
There's not a lot of time left over.
I know. Right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I have a really great community of close friends in Portland, and I do my best to be, you know, a good friend to those that I care about here in town, and make the most of what Portland has to offer. Is a very, like, pleasant, lovable city, and, like, eat good food, have a couple good beers, see some music every once in a while, and enjoy the Northwest, since it's a wonderful place to be outside. That's pretty much it.
Okay.
pretty simple living out if it's not bike related.
Well, Brenna, this has just been a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate you talking with me. How can people follow the team or the teams?
Yeah.
If you could give us that information, and then I'll let you get back to whatever you were doing.
Absolutely. I am personally active on Instagram primarily for social media, and I'm at Bruno and or Brenna. And then similarly, my road team is on Instagram. They are DNAK4. Team SNMCX is on Instagram and Twitter, and findable via those platforms if you search for us. And you can also always visit our website, which is just TeamSNMCX.com, and sign up for our newsletter there. We try to be pretty engaging with our periodic blog posts and newsletters to update everyone with what we're up to. And I try to be proactive about broadcasting both what I'm doing during the road season and the cross season, and how it all fits into Oregon bike racing and so on.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me. We've been speaking with Brenna Rye Simpson. And if you are just listening, she is a bike mechanic. She manages the S&M cross team. She races for DNA Cycling. She is really a master of them all. You'll have to go to some of these websites. We will post them all on our Facebook page. I hope you have a wonderful 2020 season. If you get to Sea Otter, please say hello. And thank you so much again.
Oh, man, I can't thank you enough for your time, Diane. It's been a fun interview to do, and I really appreciate you reaching out.
Okay, you take care.
You too. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Brenna Rye Simpson joined me from Sellwood Cycle and Repair in Portland, Oregon. If you're interested in following Brenna, you can check her out on most of the social media platforms. On Instagram, she goes as Bruno and or Brenna. And you can find out more about the S&M Cyclocross team itself at teamsandmcx.com. So before we take a break, let me remind you once again that you still have some time to pledge your support for WJCU during our annual Radiothon. Grab your credit card, log on to wjcu.org and click that Radiothon button, or you can call 216-397-4438 to give your pledge to a real live person. Okay, it's break time, and when we come back, we'll speak with Ellie Sias from Cycle of Life Adventures. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University. We'll be right back.
are back. I'm Diane Jenks, and you are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. I know there are a lot of touring companies out there doing a great job offering a wide variety of cycling adventures, but it was my great good fortune to speak with Ellie Sias about her company, Cycle of Life Adventures, and learn about some of the interesting and unique touring opportunities she offers. Hi, Ellie. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Hey, good morning, Diane.
Well, I want to know about you and your business. I love when women run businesses. I love when they found and direct businesses, and that would be you. So let's talk about Cycle of Life Adventures and how you got into that business.
Okay. Well, I've been an avid cyclist most of my life, but I really started at about age 45. And prior to that, I was a physical education teacher in Baltimore City. And every other Wednesday, I took groups of girls out on bicycle tours and taught them how to change flat tires and take care of their bikes, et cetera. And so that was really my start in the bicycle tour industry. For most of my adult life, I was actually in the entertainment business. I ran a huge outdoor event in Atlanta, Georgia. So I dealt with hundreds of thousands of people each season. And while I was running this outdoor event, I had limited time when I could ride a bike. So I would take tours all over the country with a number of different tour companies. And one year I went on a tour and met a man who is now my partner and business partner, and the rest is history.
It is. So wait, I want to back up a second and ask about your big event, your entertainment event. What kind of an event was it?
It's very different from the bicycle industry. I ran an outdoor event every spring in Atlanta. It was called the Georgia Renaissance Festival. And
wow.
It was a lot of hard work, a lot of different hats that I wore. And by the time I was in my mid-50s, I was wearing out. I was, tired of working so hard. Not that I don't work plenty hard now, but I decided that I wanted to start doing something fun and enjoyable every day. So I decided to get into the bicycle business. I looked around for companies that might be willing to sell or move on, and I found no one. So when I met Dennis on a tour in New Mexico, we looked at each other because we both had the same dream, and we said, we can do it. And so a year and a half later, we started Cycle of Life Adventures.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Ellie Sias. Is that the right pronunciation?
It is, yes.
Oh, well, good for me this morning.
And well, my partner's name is Dennis Hughes.
Yes. I was going to get to that, yes. And when you go on to the website, you'll be able to meet both of them in virtual time. So it is interesting that you and your partner run this business. My now husband, it took 17 years before we got married, but ran our bicycle business together, and we had that same kind of dream together. And it when it works so well. So well.
It does.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know what makes Cycle of Life Adventures different from the companies that you took tours with that you found some dissatisfaction with, and not to say they were bad companies, that they weren't exactly what you wanted.
No, and they weren't bad companies at all, and I wasn't dissatisfied with them. I think what it was I had traveled with one company for so many years during my free time where they had a limited schedule. And so I ran out of tours that I could do with them. So then I tried another company, and their tours were limited. And then I met Dennis on a tour with a group out of Colorado. And they did a fine job with their tours as well. I think that most people that are in this industry are very customer oriented. And I think that perhaps those of us who are smaller companies may be a little bit more customer oriented because, you know, once we get this guest, we need to keep them and so as to grow our business. I believe that the smaller companies like ourselves are more attuned to the details than the large corporate tour companies.
Interesting.
So, like as an example, we will only take 12 people on a tour with us because it gets too difficult to, quote, entertain them, dine them, wine them, keep an eye on them on the road, keep them safe. We rarely ever would go above 15 people. So it is a small, intimate group, and they become our friends.
I totally understand that. We're in the custom bicycle business. I understand how you make friends with your clients. They become friends almost before they become clients, or certainly at the same time. So if you're only taking 12 people, and it's you and Dennis, and I am sure there are other tour guides, your site lists so many tours for 2020, including one that's going to begin in Florida next week, which, you know, that we would love that. It's freezing where we are. We're in Cleveland.
Right.
And you say that an owner will be on all the tours. So how do you accomplish that?
How do we swing that? It's not easy, to be perfectly honest. So what we do, we have like 29 locations around the country that we do. And if you look at our schedule closely, they're clustered somewhat seasonally. So at this time of year, we're in the southeast in Florida. And this coming week, we'll go to St. Augustine and we'll wrap Florida up. We're coming from coastal Carolina right now. And after that, Dennis flies to Tucson and meets our tour leader there. They do a Tucson trip. After that, we are in Texas. So you can see a pattern here. We're staying south and we're moving east again. So we go from Texas to New Orleans to the Natchez Trace and then to a few things on the East Coast before we head west. And then in the fall, summer and fall, we'll be back in the east again. So we have about 29 locations, and either Dennis or myself will be on a trip with another guide. And there are several trips that go more than once per year, but they're usually clustered very close together on the schedule. So about 75% to 80% of our trips are a go. Occasionally, if we don't have enough guests to do a trip or 2 months out, we will, quote, pull the plug on it and try to accommodate them on another trip. But we always want to do it 2 months out so they have time to do travel plans and such. And that's pretty typical in the industry. Not everyone's tours go every time.
Of course. No, I can certainly see that.
Yes.
Well, the way your company was brought to my attention is something new you're doing this year. I know you call certain tours epic, and you're taking several of your regular tours in Colorado and combining them. So tell me about that tour, and then I want to go back and talk about your Fundo kind of fun tours. But let's talk about this big tour in Colorado.
Our epic tours are typically tours that are 2 weeks or longer. And our epic Colorado is really not new. We have been doing it for the last three seasons. And what we do is we take our Southwestern tour, our Colorado Monument, our Aspen Highlands, and now our Colorado Fundo, and we combine them. And if you look at the schedule, we make one tour meet where another one ends, and then we add on to them. We give a day or two between the different tours. So what we're doing is we're creating a nice long vacation for people that are traveling greater distances. Most of our Colorado trips, we don't draw from the Colorado area. We're drawing from the Big East coast cities or Europe, or last year we had a couple from New Zealand and one from Australia. So when you're traveling those distances, you don't want to just ride for 5 days. So we're sort of making it worth their while to come and enjoy an area for a much longer period of time.
Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Ellie Sias. She is one of the founders and tour directors for Cycle of Life Adventures. Interesting title, by the way. I do like the name of your company. I think that's awesome.
And it's because we were entering a new cycle of our life. We're both retiring and getting out of former businesses, and this was a perfectly good name.
Yeah, I was thinking of retiring too. In fact, I said I did, but I evidently didn't. So let's take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Ellie some more. I want to talk about her fundos, and I want to talk about some of the reasons that we're going to book a Cycle of Life adventure. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Ellie Sias. She's one of the founders and the director of tours for Cycle of Life Adventures. We talked about your epic tours, something where you can kind of add on, you know, each week. And I assume that people can pick any part of that and join that tour, or they can do the whole thing.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Certainly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that attracted me on your website is that not all of your tours are epic. And you have a short winter tour coming up next month in Arizona. And I would call it kind of minimalist. There's support, but it's not soup to nuts. So tell us a little more detail about that, because I think people tend, especially from this area, to look for a getaway this time of year.
Right. Well, that's exactly why we came up with the concept of a fundo, F-U-N-D-O. Not a fondo, so it's not a race and it's not a timed event. And honestly, it was not an original idea. A friend of ours in California gets a group of his buddies together every year, and they do a fondo in California. So we asked Bob if we could steal his idea, and he said, sure. And so we went with it. Our first fondo was in Asheville, North Carolina. Which is the new hotspot on the East Coast to cycle. And the idea behind a fondo is that it is inexpensive. It's meant to be fun. And we always have them in areas where there are other really fun activities. So as an example, in Asheville, we'll go to the Biltmore one day and cycle through the Biltmore, tour the Biltmore. In Kentucky, we do horse farm tours. In Arizona, we go through the Sonoran Desert Museum. In West Virginia, we go caving one day. So you can kind of see that we like to add some extra activities to it to make it a little bit of a more of a well-rounded vacation, but short and simple. And we give the guests the flexibility to do a few things on their own. And we actually design them so that each day there are two routes. So if you want to do an easier day and a harder day, that's perfectly fine with us. The van is still on the road with everyone. So a guide, you know, to help with mechanical problems and things of that sort. So they're a lot of fun. They really are.
Well, it's funny. It's funny. We have an event here in Cleveland called the Fundo. It's a one-day, you know, fundraiser for our local advocacy group. But it's just funny that people are sort of adopting this fundo name. I love it. I think it's so cool. So how often do people come back to you as their tour company?
We have about a 75% return rate.
Wow. That's amazing.
Which I think is really good.
I think so, too.
And because we have a good return rate, it forces us to be a little bit original and come up with a few new things each year.
Like
because
what?
We want those guests to come back. Well, like for this year, we have a new tour. that will be in coastal Maine. And there are plenty of tour companies that do coastal Maine, but they do Maine from about Bar Harbor and south. We do the coastal Maine from Bar Harbor and north. So we call it our Bold Coast, which is the nickname that the Maine residents refer to as in that area, because it's rugged and it's you have to be a bold, hardy individual to go out there and work and play. So we go from Bar Harbor to the Canadian border near Roosevelt's Campobello Resort. It's wilderness. It's still road biking. There are very few places to stay, so we have to plan it out well in advance. And I think it's going to be a fun, exciting tour.
How long is that? Is that a week?
It is 6 days.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
And that's one of our all-inclusive, you know, nuts to bolts sorts of tours.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So what's the average age of your client, just out of curiosity?
What would your guess be?
55 to 70.
Okay, you're right in there. It's 64.
Wow. Wow, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm. It's the average age. On the longer tours, like our cross-country tour, it's a little bit older than that.
Older?
Because, yes, most of our guests are in their late 60s and early 70s. If you think about it, those are the only people that have 45 days off work.
Well, that's true.
To go ride a bike.
That's true. Good point. Good point. What is the percentage of men and women? Are you seeing more women on your tours?
We do about 60% men, 40% women.
Not bad.
Most people would think this is like a couple's vacation sort of thing, but it's not. I'd say 50% of our travelers are solo travelers.
Huh.
So they're not riding or traveling with a husband or wife or a partner. They're on their own.
Nice. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
That way you meet new people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. So do people rent bikes from your fleet or do they bring their own?
We do rent bikes. And typically the longer the ride, the more often they bring their own bike.
Sure.
If you're on a bike for a long time, you want to be comfortable. I would say only about 20% of our guests rent a bike from us. The remainder bring their own bike. And it really depends on the difficulty of the area in which they're coming. So if they're flying to, let's say, West Virginia, they typically use one of our bikes because you're on small planes flying into the Greenbrier Valley. But if you're coming into a major airport, an awful lot of folks bring their own bikes with them because it's gotten so easy to do, and it's, you know, the airlines are more accommodating these days.
Are you seeing sort of a not an explosion, but are you seeing people beginning to ride e-bikes?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. I wouldn't say it's an explosion, but I would guess that, maybe one in 10 spouses that come along on a tour with a husband or a wife might use an e-bike. Few people do bring their own e-bike, although we have a man coming from Oregon this week bringing an e-bike with him.
Hmm.
They are, unless you go to the really high-end e-bikes, they're still a little bit heavy and hard to deal with. And I think that's intimidating for people who are not used to them. Yeah.
You also have the issue of batteries on the road, so that somebody needs to be carrying a spare battery.
We keep extra batteries with us. We keep power sources in the vans. You know, e-bikes, that industry is changing so quickly that 2 years from now, a bike that we use today will be obsolete. And they'll be much lighter and better. So I think that e-bike is a booming industry, and it'd be great for touring.
I agree. It's just, mm-hmm. you know, we get so annoyed with things becoming obsolete almost as soon as they come out. It's tough for bike shops to keep up with
it. The cell phone, right.
Right, exactly. If you were to take one of your tours and say this is the one that most people will do at least once, what do you think the favorite tour is on Cycle of Life Adventure Tours?
My favorite tour or their favorite tour?
Well, yours and theirs?
Okay. My favorite tour is anything on the Blue Ridge Parkway or Vermont.
Okay.
My partner's favorite tour is Oregon. Our best-selling tour is the Natchez Trace.
Huh.
And I love doing the Natchez Trace. It's like the very best riding surface in the country. There's no billboards. There's no traffic, no stop signs. And the cyclist gets the entire lane. It's a wonderful trip for beginner or experienced cyclists.
Yeah, we were on part of it for a tandem tour in Mississippi a few years ago. And that was mm-hmm. the last day you were on your own to go down the Natchez Trace as far as you wanted to go. And it is beautiful. It's stunning. So this has been just so interesting. I talked to a lot of tour leaders, and I really like your approach. It's not insane by any means. One thing we didn't talk about was food. Food is like we ride to eat, right?
Oh, right. It is. Yeah. And we do the best food that an area might have to offer. So we don't cook out and we don't camp. We always do hotels or inns or lodges of some sort. And occasionally we might be in a small town where we don't have access to a nice restaurant. So we'll do a grilled cookout for them. But typically our breakfast includes a nice, hearty, healthy meal at a hotel or an inn. We do a light lunch on the road as a picnic lunch, and then we dine out for dinner. We pick up all the meals for the all days when they're on one of the all-inclusive tours, and we even have like a social the first night out where we pick up their alcoholic beverages, and then for the rest of the week they're on their own for their alcohol.
Sure.
But it's a great time. It really is.
Well, I'm looking again at the schedule and I see you do an Adirondack tour. My husband's from the Adirondacks. So that's mm-hmm. kind of interesting. We've been up there, not necessarily all on our bike. There's the Natchez Trace tour back in October. Just some wonderful tours. You're already booking into 2021. So what would you say the status is of most of your tours? Are there openings or are you filled?
We have openings for almost every tour that is still on the 2020 schedule. The ones that fill up the fastest are the fundos. And most of the fundos fill up with people that are coming within a driving distance, a comfortable driving distance. The epic tours are slower to fill up. It takes a lot of thought and time and scheduling for those. But for the most part, we have openings on most tours.
This has been just fascinating. We've been speaking with Ellie Sias. She is one of the founders and the director of tours for Cycle of Life Adventures. And I want you, if you would please, to tell my listeners how they can find out more about your company and your tours.
Actually, Diane, the best place would be for them to visit our website, cycleoflifeadventures.com. The tours are well described on the website, and they can certainly give us a call. We're in and out of the office all day. If we're not here, our phones are forwarded to a sales rep in Colorado or Virginia, and our number is 303-945-9886.
Once again, Cycle for Life Adventures, Ellie Sias, one of the founders and tour director of tours. Thanks so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate it. Good luck with your booking season.
Thank you, Diane.
All right.
Goodbye.
Bye. Ellie Sias joined me from, I'm not sure exactly where she was in the moment, but she's on the road virtually all the time and was getting ready to head down to Florida for an upcoming tour. If you're interested in learning more about Cycle of Life Adventures, you can log on to their website. Yep, cycleoflifeadventures.com. So I hope you enjoyed this week's show. My thanks to Ellie and to Brenna Rice-Simpson from Selwood's S&M Cross Team in Portland, Oregon. Our question last week, are you planning on taking a tour of any sort? It produced some really interesting results. You guys are traveling all over the place from Mississippi and Florida to a great many fundraising rides. If you'd like to see all the responses, you can find them on the Outspoken Cyclist Facebook page. This week's question, do you ride regular clinchers with tubes, tubeless, or are you one of those retro daring types who still ride sew-ups? I'm interested in those responses. We'll be back next week with a brand new show, and please remember to take a moment to log on to WJCU and pledge your support during our once-a-year fundraising week. The pledge window will remain open until Monday evening, February 24th. So I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe out there. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.